Isaiah, we're in chapter 9. We got part way into 9 last week. We saw, a big band of darkness spreading over Israel. Why?
Because of their breaking the covenant.
Because of breaking covenant? Consequences of choices. And I love that. Consequences of choices. One of the things that I hope, and Michael prayed about this, I paid him to pray about it, by the way, was that we could find personal or modern application from these things. See, God holds a nation accountable on the principles that reflect his governance, his character, his disposition. And the people say, well, keep religion out of politics. That's like shut your brain down before you vote. And he says, don't vote your morals. Where do your morals come from? Where do your ethics come from? See, Alan, there's a thing about us that isn't true about a lot of people. That is, we know how God thinks. We know how God thinks about the way we treat people in this society. And there's a lot of culture in our society that says this is the way we ought to treat people, and it's really hurting them because they don't know the mind of God. Now, it looks like compassion, but it really is oppression, keeping people down rather than, and there's a lot of ways we can go with that, and I don't want to go down that trail very far, only to say that as we see God holding Israel accountable for the way they behave, we'll understand what God is looking for in any people. So that when you go to the ballot box, you might be swayed by the emotional argument on this side or the emotional argument on that side, but what I'd rather you do is answer the question, how does God think about this? And that's one of the things we're going to be getting out of this study through the book of Isaiah. How did God look at them, and why did God do such awesome things? When I say awesome, I mean frightfully difficult things. Our God, we learn in Hebrews, is a consuming fire. Hebrews 10, our God is a consuming fire, not one to be taken lightly. Not this laughing in the closet, looking down at us, but a God that expects morality. Anyway, why was there a pale of darkness coming over Israel? One of the things is, if you will not believe, this is what God said to Ahaz, King Ahaz, regarding the two small nations that were about to invade him, that you don't have to worry about them. If you will not believe, you will not stand. Good. You will not stand. Said, ask for a sign. Ahaz was too arrogant to say, I don't need a sign. God gave him a sign anyway. The length of time between when a child born to a young maiden would know enough to choose right from wrong. These two nations you're worried about be gone. But if you won't believe, you won't stand. What did he do because he didn't believe what God said? Remember what he did? Very important piece. What did he do? Ahaz.
He went to the other.
He hired the big dog to come take care of it. He didn't trust God to take care of him, so he hired Assyria to come take care of his problem. And Assyria, well, since you didn't believe God, you're not going to stand. Assyria gobbled too. God said in chapter 8, verse 13, Yahweh of hosts, whom you should regard as holy, not the spiritist, the wise men among your people, not the counselors to the king, none of those people who are giving the advice. Yahweh is the one you regard as holy, and he shall be your fear, and he shall be your dread. If you don't learn to respect God, if you don't say, what do the scriptures say? Like down here in instead of what verse I'm looking at now, verse 19, instead of consulting the Medians, you should say, verse 20, to the law and to the testimony. To the law and to the testimony. What does God say? And if they're not willing to do that, it's because they have no dawn. They're going to go into darkness because they don't trust what God says. They don't even consult him. They don't look for his input. And I want to say again that we're a nation of people that it seems like we vote two or three times every year, doesn't it? There's this vote and that vote. And how are you going to vote? To the law and to the testimony. What does God say? And if you don't go that way, it's going to end up you don't have any dawn. The night is the day is going to go dark on you. But even when, and I like this piece at the end of 8, let me not skip over it lightly, where he says in verse 21, they will be enraged and they will curse their king. You're not giving us what we want. You're not providing us what we think we need. You're not doing it the way we'd like you to do it. I want the abortion on demand. You know, curse their king because we don't get what we want, and their God, and shake an angry fist at him, and then they'll go into darkness. So a people that ignore the ways of God are doomed to go into darkness. But God to the rescue. You know, like Paul said in Romans 7, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? God to the rescue. He says here in chapter 9, there will be no more gloom. There will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. The day is coming when the gloom will be gone. What it says here in verse 2, the light will shine on them. And end of verse 2. Now, we connected that, didn't we, with Matthew 4. At the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, just after he was baptized by John, began his public ministry, and Matthew quoted this passage and saying, that's what Isaiah was talking about. Jesus preaching the light to the people of Israel. And so you will multiply the nation, you'll increase their gladness, they will be glad in your presence, you'll break their yoke, the rod of the oppressor will be broken. Because verse 6, a child will be born to us. A son will be given to us. Now that has to be a nod to the promise in 7:14, virgin giving birth, and the trouble that they were facing being gone. And as I suggested then, and I will suggest again now, that what was happening with Isaiah and his wife when they had Mahershalal Hashbaz, the second child, my two sons are signs, he said in chapter 8. What was happening there was a picture of what God was ultimately going to do. Here is the ultimate. A son will be born, a child will be given. A child will be born, a son will be given. And what will happen? The government will be on his shoulders. He will govern us in a way that are multiply the nation, increase the gladness, be glad in your presence. That's up there in verse 3. Why would that happen? He would be, verse 7, on the throne of David. Why would that happen? In spite of the gloom and the darkness that was about to envelop the nation for 400 years. Before 600 years, 700 years, from 721 to BC to 33 AD. What's that? That's 750 years. A gloom and a pale of darkness envelop the country. Why could they expect that there would be light at the end of that tunnel? Okay, the promise, but there's something even more powerful. The promise was carried out because God was zealous for it. The zeal of Yahweh of hosts will accomplish this. I'm going to get this done because I'm on fire for my people. It's not, oh, I got to keep this promise. I got to do it. As It's my the zeal of Yahweh will get it done. And that is a 10-minute review of what we covered last time to set us up to where we're going. So that's, as we typically do, here's a problem, here's what it's going to cost you, but I'm coming to the rescue. Now, we'll see that pattern repeated throughout the book. Here's the problem, but don't worry, I've got you covered. So we're going back to more of the problem. Now, from chapter 8, or 9, verse 8, through chapter 10, about verse 4, we have four sections that end with this phrase, "And all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out." Four times that we repeat that. And first time I ever studied this, I was studying under the auspices of a teacher. And the point that he made on that he thought was right, and I actually even have it written in the notes of my Bible, and I've changed my mind on it because I've read it in other places, that this hand stretched out was not a hand of mercy or a hand to help or a hand to pull you up out of the ditch. It was a hand to spank. His hand is still, which says that what's happening is Israel isn't changing. So we're going to see that four times. And then because Israel isn't changing, isn't changing, isn't changing, isn't changing, I'm bringing Assyria in to cut them down. That's beginning 10, verse 5, where Assyria becomes the rod of God's discipline in his hand. Assyria is that. Okay, so we've got this phrase, his hand is still stretched out and his anger is not turned away. If it had been read that way, you wouldn't confuse it with, well, his anger is there, but I'm going to rescue you. You say, my hand is still stretched out and my anger is not relenting. Okay, I get it. First one, beginning of verse 8, Yahweh sends a message against Jacob and it falls on Israel. And all the people know, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, asserting in pride and arrogance of heart, "The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with smooth stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will replace with cedars." Therefore, Yahweh raises against them adversaries from Rezin and spurs their enemies on. Their Arameans on the east and the Philistines on the west, and they devour Israel with gaping jaws. In all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. You notice that I conveniently, purposely left out the italicized words in the New American Standard, where it says, in spite of all this. I don't think in spite of carries the same power that in all this happened, and his anger hasn't turned away. Why is it that God's anger didn't turn away when all that happened? There's one reason.
They didn't repent.
They what?
They didn't wake up.
They didn't wake up. They did not repent. They didn't turn around, right? And so all this has happened. All what? In all this. Each time the in all this is going to be just that paragraph of what he's talking about. What did he talk about here? What did you pick up out of this reading? Look at verse 9. Asserting in pride and arrogance. Okay, you got some gaping jaws going on, don't you? Arameans on verse 12, Arameans on the east, Philistines on the west. They devour Israel with gaping jaws. What happens when two different nations come in and start devouring you with gaping jaws? What's happening? Infrastructure being destroyed. Ah, that's all right. You tore down bricks, we'll build with nice smooth stones. You cut down our sycamore trees, we'll grow cedars instead. What's going on?
Not facing reality.
Not facing reality. Minimizing, arrogating, there's arrogance and pride. You took away this. We'll just build with something better.
Because we have the temple and God is the Tekelah.
or whatever reason they were using. See, they weren't saying, wow, God is letting these things happen to us. Maybe we better look at why these things are happening to us rather than, well, you think you can do that to us? We'll just rebuild better. Notice the we in there. Okay, so sin number one seems to be this arrogance that allows people to overlook something bad's happening to us. We maybe ought to change what we're doing. Ah, we can fix that. We'll fix it. We'll build back better. Okay? Does that sound like a politician? Second, chapter 9, 13 through 17. Yet the people do not turn back to him who struck them. See, we start, even start with that. Yet they don't turn back, nor do they seek Yahweh of hosts. Remember what we read back in chapter 8 to the law and to the testimony? If why would you consult mediums and spiritists? Why would you look for the wise men? Why would you seek counsel from some godless person? Why not ask God? See? And so they don't seek Yahweh of hosts. They don't look to God. They don't look to his word. They don't inquire of him. They got to figure it out. So Yahweh cuts off head and tail from Israel. This piece I really love. He cuts off head and tail from Israel, palm branch and bulrush in a single day. The head is the elder and the honorable man, and the prophet who teaches falsehood is the tail. That's the piece I really love. Put that guy in his place. For those who guide this people are leading them astray. And those who are guided by them are brought to confusion. You have a marginal reading on that, brought to confusion? I know Linda does.
Swallowed up.
Swallowed up by confusion. Just imagine a people so disoriented. When Jesus saw multitudes coming to him, one passage says he felt compassion for the people because they were like a sheep without a shepherd. They just didn't know what they're doing. They didn't know where to go, how to turn, how to decide. One of the things that grieves me so dearly about our country is to listen and read on Facebook feeds or YouTube young people that don't have a clue what morality is. And why they should embrace it. They have no idea the path that they're on and where it's going to take them. They're just wrong. And there's a lot of people out there say, oh, it doesn't matter. Even some of the spiritual teachers, some of the religion, I don't know what to call them. I just, do your own thing. Back when I was your age, I found a clip of a paper in the newspaper down in Texas that they this church is bragging that they had a belly dancer as one of their congregants, and that she was giving given a an opportunity to be on stage to honor God through her talents. It was just people who don't know the mind of God gonna make mistakes like that, right? They're gonna make some of them gonna make choices just because they don't know better. Some of them gonna make choices because some buddy they trust told them that that was okay. Some are just going to be guided by their impulses, but they don't know. And here it says the leadership, whether it's the honorable man, that is the prince or the king or some high official, or the prophet, the tail. They're leading my people astray, and they don't know how to conduct their lives. They don't know how to choose good. They don't know how to refuse evil because they're just walking in confusion. Now, here's the sad part about all that. You might say, well, it's not the people's fault because the leadership is. Wait, hold on. Don't they know that they have Moses and the prophets? Let them hear them. Don't they know that that's. It's so much easier just to blame my mistakes on somebody who misled me, rather than be responsible and accountable for my own choices. Here's what God says. Those who guide this people, verse 16, are leading them astray. And those who are guided by them are brought to conclusion. Therefore. Now, Alan, what is therefore, therefore?
Yeah.
Well, you're halfway, two-thirds of the way there. Every therefore is therefore what would be for. Now, you remember that one, can't you?
Yeah.
And so what went before? My people are led astray. They're confused. Oh, I can't blame the preacher and I can't blame the teacher for my confusion. Well, look, I know that's the case because look what verse 17 says. Therefore, Yahweh does not take pleasure in their young men, nor does he have pity on their orphans or their widows. That's pretty severe. I don't pity them. They made the bed they're lying. And we know from other texts that God said, I sent them my prophets rising early, ascending. You'll see that phrase frequently in Jeremiah. I sent them my prophets rising early, ascending. I could tell a hint that they're going off course. I wouldn't wait till they're miles off course when they first start. And what are they doing? Jeremiah said in chapter 6, verse 16, stand in the way and ask, where's the good way? Walk it and you'll find rest. And yet they didn't want to walk with God. And so now what happens when you have a society that just completely ignores God calling them to this way of life? And you get people like orphans and widows in that society as a product of that society, as a product of that mindset. So I have no pity on them. I have no pity on them. Every one of them is godless and an evildoer. Every mouth is speaking foolishness. Now, I'm not going to tell you what he said, but I'll tell you, it was, how long have we lived in that house? 25 years? We lived in the one before that? 10 years? It was before that. So 35, 40 years ago, I'm in Terre Haute, Indiana, and I got a study with a young family, and they got this little kid, must have been no more than 3 years old. And he's going around using the filthiest language you'd ever heard. The kid, the three-year-old kid right there now, while we're having a Bible study, they're laughing at it. That's 35, 40 years ago. It's happening right here in America. Now that kid's grown up. He's 45 years old. How old are you? 45, 44, 38. You're pushed. I'm not asking her. She's a woman. Hey, that little kid I'm talking about would be somewhere your guy's age. What's he like if he's still alive? Hey, what does God think about that? What does that do to society? That's an erosive force that destroys every fiber, moral fiber of society. God hates it. He says here, every one of them is godless and an evildoer. Every mouth is speaking foolishness. What does speaking foolishness mean to you? Every mouth is speaking foolishness. Yeah, it's more than that. It's more than that. It's self-will. It basically, it's self-will. The fool has said in his heart, there's no God. He's his own boss. He's just speaking what he wants. So it's more than speaking without knowledge. It's just like, whatever I say is what I want, and that's what's going to happen. And so in all this, his anger doesn't turn away. And his hand is still stretched out. Yeah, I can see it. Here's the arrogance. And then we turn into this godlessness where nobody knows to choose the right. And then we come to verse 18. For wickedness burns like a fire and consumes briars and thorns. What wickedness is he talking about? He's talking about the cultural wickedness. Now, what's the burning? Burns fire. Keep reading. It even sets the thickets of the forest aflame, and they roll upward in a column of smoke. By the fury of Yahweh of hosts, the land is burned up, and the people are like fuel for the fire. Is he talking about literally burning the countryside? Or is he talking about the people's attitude is burning? He shook head at both of those. Are you double-minded? Pardon? But it is the one is the physical manifestation of the other. And by the way, the Hebrew mindset allows both to be true. If you find yourself saying, is he talking about this or is he talking about this? The author's saying, yeah, I wanted you to catch both ideas. I mean, what's happening to the countryside is pillaging, burning it up because of invaders. But why is that happening? Because the people are burning each other up. I mean, keep reading. And they slice off on the right hand and are hungry. Let me back up to verse 19. By the fury of Yahweh hosts, the land is burned up, and the people are like fuel for the fire. No man spares his brother. So now it's not a literal fire; it's a fire of wills, of hostility. Okay, they slice off on the right hand but are hungry, and they eat on the left hand but are not satisfied. Each of them eats the flesh of his own harm. Manasseh, Ephraim, and Ephraim, Manasseh. Together they are against Judah. What's the picture that comes to your mind as you read that? I can tell you what
Civil
comes to your mind.
War.
A nation fighting amongst itself, or I mean, in the United States right now, we've got people ripping each other online and in person. And if you don't like what Charlie Kirk says, shoot him in the neck. You got that kind of stuff going on. The hostility. You got figures of speech, you're eating, but consuming, right? And in all this, his anger doesn't turn away. I mean, you'd think, wouldn't you think, that people put the brakes on and say, this ain't working to do it this way. Instead, they're saying, get out of my way. We're going to do it my way. And it just gets worse. And I'm saying it ain't new. But that's what Isaiah was dealing with. That same kind of style, where people of the same nation devouring each other, if not literally cannibalism, devouring each other, to where hatred and animosity and contempt and worse exists. And all this, his anger doesn't turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. So we come to chapter 10. Woe to those. Now, remind me what woe means. Woe to those. If you could say it, pardon? Yeah, that's good. Or, oh no. When do you say, oh no? When something bad happens or something bad is about to happen. See, somebody made the wrong choice. Have you ever driven down the road and missed your exit? Oh no. It's like, yeah, that's minor. But there are things like, I forgot to take my meds today. Oh no, I hope I can make it, you know. Or
Think about somebody not paying attention, they're gonna step out into the busy road, and you scream, "Stupid!"
yeah.
It's the same thing.
Or
Or look at help.
mom watching her 3-year-old toddler chase a ball out into the street, oblivious to the street and neck. Yeah. Oh no.
What?
Whoa. It's not a pronunciation of judgment. It's an acknowledgement of something bad is about to happen. Yes, Michael?
Could you replace that with woe as to beware? Beware to those who enact evil statutes or
I would make it stiffer than that. I would make it because it's not just beware. It's oh no. I mean, it's got
a negative connotation.
very negative, but a negative connotation of an expression of sorrow and of grief and of foreboding. Okay.
Inevitability.
Yeah, that too. Here, woe to those who enact evil statutes. Who enacts evil statutes? Leave out the word evil. Who enacts statutes?
Government
Congress?
leader.
Okay. And who constantly record unjust decisions. So who are we talking about here in verse one? Who really, without paying attention to the actions, who's doing the actions? Who are we talking about?
King and priest.
Though I would say, oh, the king and priest, king and a false prophet, okay, who or judge? Go ahead.
About the whole thing about word posting and everything, that basically they're doing it to each other.
They
It's
are.
not just the lead people, it's the people underneath are doing it to each other along with the other people.
Yeah. Oh, without question. And that's what he addressed back here in verse 16. Those who guide these people are leading astray, and those who are guided by them are brought to confusion, whether it's the leadership or the followership. They're both going down the wrong track. But I think here he's looking at those who have the ability to pass the laws that come onto society, and then those who are the judges of those laws, see, that constantly record unjust decisions. And so people are passing laws and people are making judgments that impact whom? Keep reading. So as to deprive the needy of justice, rob the poor of my people of rights, in order that widows may be their spoil and that they may plunder the orphans. So we've got a culture. We've got a culture that seizes power not for the sake of governing justly, but for the sake of lining pockets or in some other way gaining advantage. They have the power, they can do it, and they choose to do it. And what does God think about that? That's where we're going with this one. Now, compare this verse 2. Rob the needy, rob the poor, widows and orphans be their plunder and spoil. Consider what true religion undefiled before God and the Father are, according to James 1, verse 27. To visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. That word visit means to go see what they need. Not just go knock on their door and have a cup of coffee with them. Go see what they need with the purpose of meeting that need. The pure religion. You want to know what it really is to serve God purely? Take care of the people who need you. But what we have here is taking advantage of the people who can't fight back. Now, what will you do in the day of punishment? That implies punishment's coming. What will you do? You guys who are taking advantage of my, what will you do in the day of punishment? And in the devastation which will come from afar. Come from afar. How far away? Oh, can you say Nineveh, capital of Assyria? There in the highlands of the Aramean highlands, even further east than there. Headwaters of the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers. To whom will you flee for help? Where are you going to go? You hired this guy to come in and help you, and he's going to come in and bash you. Where are you now? You're going to go for help. And watch more than this. All this plunder. See, you've made the statutes and you passed the judgments for the purpose of draining the poor of whatever they have. And where will you leave your wealth? Nothing but to crouch among the captives or fall among the slain. And all this, his anger does not turn away. So we have four scenarios here where God's anger is being poured out upon this people. Their arrogance, their ignorance, their wickedness, and their greed. That if I could sum those four sections, arrogance. The bricks are gone, but we'll use smooth paving stones instead. The sycamores are gone. Well, we'll use cedars, much more valuable wood. Their ignorance. They lead my people astray. They don't know where to turn. Their wickedness, devouring each other, and their greed. And those things, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still stretched out. What does that hand stretched out look like? Okay, verse 5. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger. There's an important lesson that we're going to be picking up here, and that is the way that God uses nations to carry out his will. Who owns the earth?
God
You
does.
remember what psalm it is? I own the cattle on a thousand hills. And God said that. So why do you think you're feeding me when you bring me your sacrifices is the point of that. But I own the cattle on a thousand hills. The earth is mine. I'm letting you live here as a landlord to a tenant. You get so corrupt that the house is a mess and you're destroying my property, my people, off you go. Okay. God uses nations to purge. And here's a thing, Alan, that some people struggle with. Habakkuk struggled with this, remember? You're going to use a godless nation to come and punish us? How can you use something that's worse than we are? The answer I give to that always is that it needed to be done, and it can't be done by a righteous nation. It just can't. They wouldn't do it. What kind of dog you put in the junkyard? The meanest, growliest, nastiest dog you can find. And you don't keep him as a pet. And if he bites and hurts people and mauls people, you have to put him down. But he's doing the job you need done. So God used nations that were fit to do the job that needed to be done. Now, we may not get so far tonight that we'll see that once the job was done, God then held them accountable for doing it. And that might not seem fair, but you'll see how it is. Okay? You'll see that idea. All right. So, Syria is the rod of my anger and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. He's going to punish my people for me. I send it against a godless nation and commission it against the people of my fury. To do what? To capture booty, to seize plunder, to trample down like mud in the streets. That's what I'm sending him in to do that. Hey, go in and pillage and ravage and just devastate things. What? Yeah. Now, watch this. Yet it does not so intend. What does that mean? He doesn't intend to take plunder, take booty, trample the streets?
No.
Go ahead, Linda.
Well, they don't realize they're doing it for God. They are just doing it for themselves.
Yeah, see. Oh, I have to obey God here. Yeah, that's my King's X. God told me to come in and do this, so I get trying to please God. See, keep reading. It's not it, it nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. That's why God could use Assyria, because it already had purpose in its heart to capture, to seize property. Kind of like Mr. Putin trying to do in Ukraine. Seize property. I mean, what he's doing is not new. And what they were doing back there didn't cease. There's still these megalomaniacs that have power, have money, have resources, have clout, to think, well, I'll just go and that country can't defend itself. I'll just go take it. But that's what was in the king of Assyria's heart. I'll just go take it. So let's keep reading. It says, this is the king of Assyria says, or Assyria itself says, are not my princes all kings? Hey, we've got the biggest offensive line in the whole NFL. We're the big dogs on the block. Is not Calno like Carchemish? These are capital cities of various nations that have been already captured Hamath like Arpad, or Samaria like Damascus. Now, Samaria hasn't been captured yet, but Damascus has. Is as my hand, as my hand, as my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall not I do to Jerusalem and her images, just as I have done to Samaria and her idol? What do you suppose this 10 is getting at? Whose graven images were greater. How many graven images did Jerusalem or Samaria have? Well, the answer is too many. They should have had any. Go ahead,
No, I was just
Mary.
saying that they had a bunch of idols, and that was the whole point. They weren't supposed to have any, and they put them as greater in their lives than.
But that's not his point here. The king of Assyria says the piddling few idols and graven images that Israel and Samaria or Samaria and Jerusalem have can't even compare to the majestic nature of the idols that the nations have. I've been to the museum in Chicago, the Chicago University of Chicago's Oriental Institute Museum, and I saw statuary of the Akkadians, I think it was, whose gods, one of the that they had, 13, 14 feet high. Huge. I mean, intimidating. But Israel didn't have that. His point is, if I can capture a nation who's got these great, big, huge gods, what can I do to a little bitty nation like you who's almost got no gods at all? But in fact, if you, when we get to chapters 38 and 39, we're going to see what Sennacherib said about Hezekiah destroying all the shrines and idolatry within the land. And you guys don't have a god to call on. That's his point. See, you're looking at, try to look at it through the eyes of the Assyrian. You guys don't have a god to call on. I whip these big gods, these little gods, you're going to be a piece of cake to me. See, that's what he's saying in his heart. These little gods that you have, just a piece of cake to me. And so he says, watch what he says. Then pick up in verse 12. So it will be. And so we know Assyria is coming in because God says in verse 6, I send it. All right. So it will be that when Yahweh has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, what kind of work is he talking about? Yeah. Or we're going to change the picture. It's not going to be scrubbing it clean. Picture the Sahara forest. This guy was hiring, trying to hire himself out as a tree topper. He says, what, he's a little bitty guy. He says, what makes you think, what are your qualifications? Well, you've heard of the Sahara forest, haven't you? He says, don't you mean the Sahara Desert? He says, it is now. His prowess as a tree chopper. Okay? That's the picture that we're going to go into right here. And so he says, yeah, so God is going to finish his work on Mount Zion and Jerusalem. He's going to cut down. He's going to cut the trees down. We'll see that. Now, pin this thought. Pin this thought. I'm going to cut those trees down, but when we get to chapter 11, out of the root of Jesse will come a sprout. Tree's been cut down. The Davidic line has been cut down, but out of the root of it will come a sprout. Okay, so we're cutting stuff down here. That's where we're going. So he says, when I finish my work here, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. For he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom, I did. For I have understanding and I removed the boundaries of the people and plundered their treasuries. And like a mighty man, I brought down inhabitants and my hand reached to the riches of the people like a nest. As one gathers abandoned eggs, I gathered all the earth. And there was not one that flapped its wings or chirped or even opened its beak. I say the arrogance. God says, I'm going to punish the arrogance brought him in to do all this. By the way, that's why God did use him. This ego-driven arrogance, this power-hungry feeling of superiority, nobody can stop me. And maybe it was actually true that there wasn't a human that could stop him, but he wasn't taking into account the God in heaven. Okay? He just didn't consider. And unfortunately, neither did Ahaz. If you will not believe, you will not stand. Okay. God says in verse 15, is the axe, who's the axe in this picture? Assyria. See the rod in whose hand is my indignation? Assyria is the axe. Is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Who's the one chopping with the axe?
God.
That's God. Okay? That's God. Is the saw, same illustration, to exalt himself over the one who wields it? That's like a club wielding those who lift it. You've heard the expression, the tail wagging the dog. The club said, man, I got this. And I'm boss of Mr. Axeman, Mr. Lumberjack. Like a rod lifting him who is not wood. Therefore, the Lord, Yahweh of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors. And under his glory, a fire will be kindled like a burning flame. This guy right now thinks he's got things in his grasp. God says, when I'm finished using you for what I'm trying to do, then I want you to pick up on that, what I'm trying to do. When I have finished my work on Zion and on Jerusalem, maybe I should have, when I finish my work of using you to cut down the trees of that forest, then I'm going to punish you for the arrogance that you just displayed. But I wonder, back up here in verse 12, all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem. Why the differentiation? Or is it differentiation? Is it just redundancy, repetition for the purpose of emphasis, or is there some kind of distinction that you might extract? And I
Rob.
don't know either, but I've got an idea and I'm going to share it with you. That Mount
Rob.
Zion represents the spiritual part of God's people. Jerusalem just represents the people. When I come over to the book of Malachi, which is after all of this, God says that the coming of John the Baptist and Jesus didn't use those names, but that's who he's talking about. He said, first of all, I'm going to be a refiner's fire that will purge my people so they can offer sacrifices to me. Then I'm going to turn my attention to the godless and punish them. And that may be the same thing here, to refine my people and to remove the chaff. Same picture in Matthew 3, that he will thoroughly cleanse his threshing floor. He'll gather the wheat, but the wheat is gathered after the threshing, after the pressure, after the beating. Then the wheat is gathered. Then I'll thoroughly burn. I'll burn up the chaff with a fire that you can't put out.
Just like during the Roman siege, the Christians left. Well, during the Syrian siege, a lot of good of the 10 tribes moved to Jerusalem. And then
Yeah.
on the Babylonian siege, those good people were taken out and brought to Babylon and the rest taken care of.
And see, there's an interesting thing about it. It's in the book of Jeremiah. I think it's chapter 22, 23, 24, somewhere in there. The parable of the two baskets of figs. Good figs that are really good, and bad figs that were so bad they couldn't even be eaten due to rottenness. And the people in Jerusalem thought that the people being carried off into captivity were the bad figs. God's getting rid of them. But the reality is, God took the good figs and put them where they wouldn't be destroyed. And then left the bad figs in Jerusalem to be destroyed. So I wonder here if the work on Mount Zion is the rescuing of my servants, which we'll see in chapter 65, my servants will have a new name, but you, who's the you in Isaiah? The people of Israel. And so we have this differentiation between the people of God, the Zion of God, and the people of Israel. And so maybe that's what he's getting at here. Pardon?
Remnant.
Remnant. We'll see that again in just a little minute. Okay. Is the axe to boast over the one who chops with it? Verse 15. Or is a saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That's like the club wielding the one who lifts it, or the rod who I mean, they like a rod lifting him who is not wood. So I'm not a piece of wood. I'm a human, but the rod's going to lift me. Not really. Therefore, the Lord Yahweh of hosts will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors, and under his glory, all this boasting and bragging and plundering, a fire. And the light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One a flame. And I don't know if here he is projecting down to the end of the era, down to the time of Christ, where the people of God were a fire that consumed, not through war, but as Paul said in 2 Corinthians 10, the weapons of our warfare are divinely powerful to conquer what? Philosophies and every bit of knowledge that was raised up against the knowledge of God. We're going to conquer that. Frequently, the prophets, Amos 9 does this, will talk about owning or possessing their neighbors. But Peter in Acts 15 quoted Amos 9 and applied it to taking the Gentiles by conversion, owning or possessing their neighbors. So that might be what we're talking about here. And it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day. Or we could go back to chapter 9, verse 7, where it says, the zeal, the fire within Yahweh of hosts will accomplish this. And he will destroy the glory of his forest and of his fruitful garden, both soul and body. And it will be as when a sick man wastes away, and the rest of the trees of his forest, whose forest? The rest of the trees of his forest. Assyria, okay, will be so small in number that a child could write them down. Now, I want to say this. I'm not going to, I'm going to stop that. That's how far I wanted to get, verse 19. Because verse 20 starts with a kind of a new section of God comforting Israel concerning Syria. Here, you might conclude that in this, in that, but it's a promise. A warning to Assyria: when I'm done using you, I'm going to destroy you because you got attitudes that aren't fit to be kept on the face of the earth. I might challenge God and say, why are you doing it? I might be like Habakkuk, why are you using such a godless nation to do this work? And the answer I gave already is because a godly nation couldn't do that kind of work. But the work needs to be done. So I'll use the one who's fit to do it, but then I'll punish him for having the attitudes that are like that. Now, take that thought and apply it to an apostle named Judas. The betrayal of Jesus had to be done, but it wouldn't be done by a godly man. Jesus took Judas under his wings for 3 years and could not convert him. That's kind of a harsh statement, isn't it? Jesus couldn't convert that guy. Didn't force him to be a godly person. Invited him, induced him, showed him all the value that was there in being that. But in the end, he betrayed him with a kiss for 30 pieces of silver. That's who he was. That's why God could use him for that. Then he went out and hanged himself. So he just, here, why would God use Assyria? Because he was fit for the job. But then God says, I'm going to punish you for being fit for the job, You're not the kind of nation I want roaming around free on my earth without my supervision. And I want that to resonate with you. And you look at the world today and you say, why is God letting that take place? I haven't looked at his agenda, his daily day planner. I don't know what he has in mind. But here's one thing I do know, Alan. I trust him that he will never make the wrong decision. I might un not understand why he made that decision. I might even say that's the wrong decision. But I'm speaking from my human wisdom, not his, when I say that. Okay? But we have a lot of people who, oh, God made a mistake there. No, he didn't. You just don't understand the full, you don't understand the full picture. You're not in a position to make a judgment against about what God is doing. What he's doing is sharing with us why he makes those kind of decisions and the value of those kind of decisions. I mean, here, this was going to purify his people and bring the light of the world in for everybody, doing it this way. So, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Any thoughts?
I just thinking, what would it have been like had he not done?
Wow, there's a lot of trails like that that I don't want to go down. And what would have been like if that hadn't happened, or if he hadn't done that, or hadn't stepped in here? And, on that point, there are many places where, for example, take the Davidic line, that the line of Judah, the scepter will not depart from Judah till Shiloh comes. That's a promise that was made by Israel himself to his son Judah. But there were times, does the name Athaliah mean anything to anybody? Athaliah?
His name's Mother.
Yeah,
That
she
was
killed everyone. Killed him.
Jezebel's daughter. Jezebel's daughter married the king of Judah and decided she would kill all the royal offspring so she could be queen. She missed one, a little boy, who was brought out of being protected at 8 years old. Well, I don't think it was Josiah. But the point is, there's that close to cutting off the entire Davidic line. Yet it didn't. Jotham the hurt. Anyway, I guess the point I was trying to make is God was firmly in control, even when it looked like there was a rampage.
There wasn't many of the line left when Jesus was born.
In fact, what did Amos call it? The fallen house of David. Amos called it that. And who was Joseph? He was of the house of David. He was a carpenter. And I'm not going to say he was a poor carpenter from the standpoint of the quality of his work, but I know he's a poor quality from the standpoint of the quality his living, because he was able to offer a less than required sacrifice for the birth of Jesus because he was poor. But he was of the lineage of David, and it was through him the Messiah came. Okay, so God knows what he's doing in the nations, even if I don't. Even if I don't. All right, that's enough for tonight. Any thoughts, comments, ideas?
Well, I think that a lot of these are brought up in different ways. It's just like teaching kids to do a math problem. They show them different ways to get the same outcome because some people don't understand one way.
You're right. But that reminds you of a little boy. He says, I'm not going to school today. And mom, well, why not? He says, 2 days ago, the teacher said me 2 plus 3 is 5. Yesterday, she said 1 plus 4 is 5. And I ain't going back till she makes up her mind.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's different ways of getting the message across. Yeah.